the patient should have two caregivers at all time 24/7.
Welcome back to Pete's Script. I'm Zach Hodges, a pediatric ICU fellow at UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin, a critical care fellow in Washington, D.C.
So Alice, who do we have with us today?
Today we have my two favorite pulmonologists, Dr. Parisa Caviani and Dr. Maria Arroyo. Parisa is a former Children's National resident. She did her pulm fellowship at Johns Hopkins, and we're lucky enough to get her back as a pulm attending. If you read her research, it's environmental disparities in children with asthma, but today we are asking her about post-tracheostomy care and how to best get these kids home. Dr. Maria Arroyo did her pulmonology fellowship at Children's National in D.C. She stayed on as an attending, and she is the person you want your patient to meet if you're considering a tracheostomy, especially those kids with really bad chronic lung disease. That's sort of where she specializes.
This was a great conversation. We talk about how to introduce the idea of a new tracheostomy to a family, walk them through that process of actually getting that trach and what to expect. Helps me understand a little bit more about these patients when they leave our ICU.
Yes, it is so good. Thank you both for joining us today. Before we get started, would you two mind saying who you are, where you work, and something that you enjoy outside of medicine?
Sure. My name is Parisa Caviani. I'm a pulmonology attending here at Children's National. I'm from the Midwest originally. Ann Arbor, Michigan is my hometown. And then I transplanted to DC for med school and did my residency at Children's National and then my pulmonary fellowship at Hopkins. I am super excited to be with you guys here today and to share with you something I like to do outside of work. There's a lot, but I love taking my dog for walks in DC. There are so many great parks to go to. Absolutely. And it's a super walkable city.
Great. I'm Maria Arroyo. I'm originally from Venezuela, South America, and I did my medical school there. I moved to the United States to pursue the career of pediatrics. Initially, I wanted to do PICU. So I went to New York Medical College and did residency there. And then I moved to DC to pursue pulmonary. I think it was the closest to dealing with ICU stuff and outpatient at the same time. It's literally my passion. I'm also pursuing a master's in business in healthcare. And so I have a lot of my plate right now, but I still love going out to eat. I enjoy food. So DC is a place where there are restaurants from every part of the world. So my husband and I, that's what we do over the weekends.
Definitely safe. As a pulmonologist for an ICU patient that is moving towards tracheostomy, I'd love to hear from you two. How do we want to introduce that concept? And then when is your first one-on-one meeting with the family? When should that be?
You know, Maria and I were talking about this a little before joining you guys, and I know people can have different takes on it, but we both feel that having the providers talk first is a really good place to start to try to understand why the ICU team may feel that the next step of a tracheostomy is necessary or warranted. And then that gives us the opportunity to hear a little bit more what's going on acutely and then be able to join the conversation. Following that, ideally, we would like to have a meeting that then includes maybe the primary care provider if they're super involved or if your hospital has a complex care team that knows the child really well, but other providers that might be more closely involved in the patient's care. For some of our patients, that might include neurology or oncology as well to get a global sense. And then to be able to bring all those faces and people together with the family in a family meeting.
I also want to add that we as pulmonologists, when we see these patients as outpatients, even before they get admitted to the ICU, I believe that we can have a sense on what is the risk of each patient, especially when they have chronic diseases. What will be the risk for them to have an acute respiratory failure that eventually will need a more permanent airway? So those conversations should even start before that. So sometimes we can be very good at, and then in our documentation, we can say we have a conversation with the parents, because I think that tracheostomy is such a life-changing event for the family in general, not only because there is a new thing, it's because now the family interaction, home, equipment, everything is going to change 360. So those type of conversations should happen in a kind of like a calm, safe environment. And what is the best way to do that? That when the patient is well in the clinic, when we can see them and sit down and talk to the parents, I say, okay, I foresee that if there is a major illness now with the pandemic, with COVID-19, what can we expect? What can be the best case scenario? What could be the worst case scenario? And if the worst case scenario come, I always tell the family, if you are in doubt, please tell the team to call your primary doctor, your primary pulmonologist, or whatever person that they feel supported and they feel that they know them very well. Now, like we pulmonologists, especially that we carry these patients for so long, we're part of their family. We want to be part of that decision making.
Oh, that's beautiful. Especially the idea with severe chronic lung disease, you know a family for a while and you get to sort of have them think it through before they're admitted in the hospital.
You know, where our paths overlap the most in the ICU are with kids who it's not their first contact with the medical system. They've been dealing with some kind of chronic medical problem for a number of years at times. And these parents and families have been through a lot and they know that the road ahead's not going to be easy. When we start talking about a tracheostomy, how do you set the stage for what the next few weeks are going to look like as I get that new trache and what life might look like after they leave the hospital?
It's an ongoing conversation. I'll start with that. But if the patient and the family come to a decision fork and the decision is to proceed, you know, with tracheostomy, we try to mentally prepare families that, okay, well, first, you know, there can't be a sign of pneumonia. They need to be very stable. This is a surgery that we're talking about. And so that sometimes means, you know, another course of antibiotics that they have to complete before they start talking about the OR date. And then the very first thing that I typically like to mention to families is that it's a long road to getting the tracheostomy, getting to your first trach change. And I always include the discussion of a subacute facility where some of the training may happen and where some of the weaning may happen, but really where a lot of stabilization happens as well. I typically don't put like a time date on how long all of that might take, but I sort of lay out the steps of, you know, step one is the OR, step two is the post-op recovery, and step three involves a subacute care facility.
One thing that I also try to mention when I go to that first encounter, I don't do it very often in the ICU here, but I do it very often in the NICU, in the neonatal ICU, to bring that idea for the first time to the parents. It depends on what is the indication for the tracheostomy at that point. Is it a quality of life versus let me get you home as soon as possible? So those things need to be placed in the table so the parents can have a good grasp of what they are going to encounter. But definitely something that I try to be is honest 100%. You know, especially when you have to be very honest saying that this is not the easy way out, but it's the best at this time. Once you say that, the parent goes on your side and say, you know what, whatever you recommended, I trust you 100%. Especially when you start everything with honesty, hey, we're doing this. This is how I foresee you in the future. This is the doctor that is going to follow you in the future. And we're going to have a good partnership with them so they can have a good understanding of your child even before he gets discharged and then after discharge. And this is how it can look like.
Absolutely.
You know, I have a question and follow-up that might be difficult to answer, but you know, as you see these patients years and years in follow-up after they get their tracheostomy, in the best case scenario, how good of a job do you think we can do as a healthcare system in preparing our families for what they're going to deal with? I mean, how can you actually have 100% well-informed consent?
It's a very difficult situation because I don't think even the informed consent that we sign at this point has all the information that we need, not even the legal part, but also like all the procedures and things that they have to do right after. But I'm not sure. What do you think, Marisa?
As you mentioned that, I was just searching my inbox for this list of trach resources that I keep because I think that there is a really great cartoon series that was made recently, and I just have to find the source for that. But it basically walks you through what life is like with a tracheostomy in a couple of different home environments for families. And I think that the best way to give the informed consent is to have the families talk with another family that has gone through this. Our hospital has a patient navigation program, and I think that's a great resource to use for families who are making these tough decisions.
I think that's perfectly reasonable, and we'd be happy to share that resource with our listeners.
Yeah. Once we've moved past the informed consent process, what specific things does a patient need to ultimately have in their home to be safe with a tracheostomy?
So if a patient goes home only with a tracheostomy, just changing the tracheostomy is a two-people process for any pediatric patient. So then that means that the patient should have two caregivers at all time 24/7. That means that even though there is one parent, there is always should be a second caregiver that is always available. And that shouldn't be the nurse agency. Why not? Because sometimes the nurses can call back and say, hey, I'm sick, I cannot come to work. So then the second caregiver should be there. So if you think about it overall, a pediatric patient who goes home with a tracheostomy, at least three people involved in their care, and they should be fully trained to do all the cares for this patient. And then, of course, we have how the house should look. You know, they should have a place for the ventilator, the suction, the oxygen tanks that are gigantic and they occupy a big space. It's not a must to have their own room. They can share the room with the parents. And I would say that the initial part is that's the majority what they do. They share the room with the child. And there is always an awake caregiver next to the patient at all times. And of course, equipment, there is a list of things that they need to have. If the patient has a ventilator with a tracheostomy, there is always a second ventilator. Believe it or not, every patient that goes home with a ventilator, there is always two. There is one as a backup in case of power outage of the ventilator stop working. And I have a parent that had the screen went red and it stopped working. So she had to use her backup ventilator. And then they have a ventilator that has a setup that stay in the house. And then the ventilator that is for transport that is considered the backup ventilator.
Oh, nice. I can think of a small handful of families that have more of a historic home and their electricity isn't up to code. How do you know when you're having that conversation? Like, how does that problem arise?
We usually don't have that system of going to evaluate the house. By default, the company who provides all the equipment for the patient should be able to make sure there are enough plugs to plug all the equipment. But we had a family that had a power outage because there was too many things connected to the power, and it was an old house in DC. So Alice, that's an amazing question because we don't do that often. And they had to use the battery operated in the inside the ventilator, and it's usually good for 8 hours. So it's something that could be, you know, replaced. And then they have the backup ventilator available also. So it's not something that we need to run out and come back to the hospital, but it's something that needs to be taken care of.
It comes up also for families who live in mobile homes because you need to, you know, live in a place that also could have a backup generator if they lost power. And so Maria brings up a good point that it's not like built into the system perfectly, but we really try to get to know our patients when we start to have these conversations to get a sense of what does the home environment look like for them before we bring in the home care company that does the formal evaluation. Mm-hmm. It's helpful to get a sense of what you may be up against logistically.
That makes sense.
And you guys reviewed for us, it's an exceptional amount of equipment these families need to set up what's essentially a mini ICU in their home. I know as physicians that we're kind of somewhat removed from the cost of these things, but do you find that insurance companies will cover nearly all of these materials, or are families having to pay out of pocket for a lot of these things?
Insurance companies typically cover all of this. We're talking about like the ventilator, the backup ventilator, batteries. They all need self-inflating bags and masks, suction equipment, heated humidifier, supplemental oxygen. Everyone has to have for emergency use, even if the patient's not going home on oxygen. And most have like a nebulizer machine as well. But insurance does typically cover the cost of these things.
And then also you have the little things that are also needed, like tracheostomies, suction catheters, syringes. If the patient has a cough as minimal as the syringe that goes to the cough to inflate or deflate. Not by default, but the majority of the patients who have tracheostomy, they also have G-tubes. So there is also G-tubes, tubing, pump. So it's a lot. And especially when you see some families are very organized or very methodic. Mm-hmm. And when they come to the clinic, they want to show you all the equipment so you approve it. You have to see the car seat or whatever they are on, the stroller, I'm sorry, is full so much. And they have so many bags and the emergency kit for like ambu bag and a smaller tray. Oh, so it's a lot of like, it's a grocery list.
It sounds like everyone needs to have, I'm trying to think of a situation where maybe trach and no vent or something. What's the spectrum of home nursing required? Is it generally you should just think about 24 hours to start and then back off if possible?
So it's very insurance driven, sadly. I think that's the medical system where we live on. And ideally, these patients have 16 hours total of nursing. So it's like 8 hour day shift and then 8 hour night shift. But with the pandemic and COVID-19 and all the shortages of everything and even human power, we don't have mm-hmm. enough nurses. So I have to encounter some parents that they only get like 8 hours of a daytime nurse. And then nighttime, how it looks is like the parents do shift during the night. So I have parents that the mother took 7 p.m. to 2 a.m. and then the father wakes up and then take the shift at 2 a.m. till next day.
Wow. Because someone always needs to be awake.
I can't imagine what a burden this is to the families. Like just hearing how they convert their entire schedule to every waking hour is helping taking care of their medically fragile child. Do you feel that with the COVID pandemic and maybe some limitations in nursing care, has that affected children's health in a significant way? Like I would imagine kids would have more complications, to be coming to the hospital more, may even perhaps influence a family's decision to provide their child a tracheostomy. Have you seen that at all?
I think parents were doing a lot of caring for their chronically vented or chronic trach patients at home on their own. So I was seeing a mm-hmm. lot of parent burnout in that sense, because they were understandably unwilling to trust someone from outside the home coming into the home. So at the beginning, some families were cutting down on their nursing hours because they wanted to do everything themselves and didn't want to risk sure. someone coming into the home and bringing in the virus. And so that was certainly a challenge. And like Maria was saying, for many of us as providers, as individuals, vaccination has changed how we may take certain risks. But for our patients who are have tracheostomies and have ventilators, those risks are still as calculated as they were, you know, at the end of March for many of us, absolutely. March of 2020.
Once we've sort of discussed the tracheostomy decision with the family and we move towards the surgery, there are two potential paths. One is ICU to acute care facility to home, and one is ICU to home. Even if we're planning on transfer to a subacute care facility, what needs to happen between the surgery and transfer? What milestones do we need to hit?
I love this question because we get consulted a lot for this, and it's very important. I love that you guys consult pulmonary for that, because there are certain things that need to be done. In our practice, I have seen the benefits of transition or ease the way home of these patients, because when they are in the ICU setting, the nurse at bedside is usually guiding the parents or at least helping. Some parents are very good at, I'm going to do everything, just be a fly on the wall and then I do the rest. But some parents, they are not going to be. What I will suggest is that we should ease transition home. So send them from the ICU to a step down facility and then go home is actually much better. The step down facility in any location in the United States should be able to provide services like education, one-to-one with the nursing staff in that step down facility. So we can do a more, because when we go through medical school, we go through residency, all of that, it takes time to learn. So we cannot expect parents to learn all these medical terms and cares for kids that they have never done this before. So especially I have seen the benefits. And what is a benefit is that it decreased the readmission of the patient after discharge directly from the ICU. So we have seen the benefits of sending those patients to that subacute facility. Then the ICU doctor calls us and say, you know, we think he's ready to go home, there are many questions that comes up. One of the things is that, is these pressures enough for him to go to the subacute facility or home? I think for the subacute facility, especially if that facility has the intervention of any physician that is there that can actually help weaning or monitor whatever settings the patient is, I don't think there is a limit. I think if there is a respiratory stability and a clinical stability with the patient without any major events in the last, for me, it's like maybe like 3 or 5 days, I would be comfortable sending the patient to the subacute facility, whatever settings or pressures. I have patients at home that are on a PEEP of 10, 11. I have right now my biggest PEEP is at 14. So, and they can make it. And of course, those kids are very special cases that are very sick. But I think once you get to that respiratory stability, don't change anything. Just leave them alone, watch them and see if there is any major event. If not, we're good with the settings. Then the other thing is that, and Zach, maybe, I don't know if you guys practice this in your location, is that for the patient to be able to transfer from one location to another one, sometimes we need to change equipment. Mm-hmm. And some patients are very sensitive to equipment change. By default, every vent, when I say transport vent, will do exactly the same thing. It will give you a pressure, a PEEP, a rate, a PIP, whatever you need to set on the ventilator. But I will say that to be safe, I usually recommend to trial the patient before the transport, whatever it is, home or subacute facility. Let's say if the ride is 30 minutes, I will do it for maybe like 3 hours. Mm-hmm. Just to say maybe a lot of traffic, maybe something happened. And then, of course, the process of getting the patient from the room down to the ambulance, then ride, then go to the other facility, and then transition him to the other equipment. We have to take that into consideration. So I usually do that once the patient passed the trial, then they are ready to transition whenever. We don't need to keep them on those equipment. 3 hours is good enough to go on the transport. Because usually the transport services, they use their own ventilators. And for us, it's like LTVs. Mm-hmm. That's our transport team, what they use. But some other locations can use other ventilators.
I'm just going to play devil's advocate to what Maria said. If you call us and you say, oh, this child got a tracheostomy 15 days ago, did the first trach change, is, on a PEEP of 14 and we want to send them home, I probably would say hold the phone, because what's the plan? What's the plan going forward here? And I only say that, like Maria was saying, these are like exceptional patients who have really high pressures on an outpatient setting. And her measure of stability for that patient is probably a little more time compared to the other patients who are on lower settings. But I raise that point to say that's one of the benefits of a subacute facility, is you get to demonstrate stability on what would otherwise be considered perhaps an alarming home setting, is that you allow the family and the patient and the provider a little more time to establish those settings as stable before you send them home into an environment that doesn't have a respiratory therapist, that doesn't have a nurse, that doesn't have an on-call provider, that has very different, sensitivities and alarms compared to the monitoring that happens in an ICU environment.
Alarm sensitivity is something that I hadn't even thought about. This is also makes me feel differently about, because I do think that when I'm weaning, am I weaning these settings enough? Does he truly need every single one? Like, are we backing off enough slowly? And it's really nice that that could happen in a stepwise fashion elsewhere, as opposed to, does he really need this much pressure support? Like, does the rate, things like that.
Usually my best indication for PEEP of 14 is ARDS, but I'm sure there's something different here.
Homemade PRV for her.
Sometimes really bad tracheomalacia or bronchomalacia, especially in BPD population. But to your point, Alice, exactly, right? As the intensivist, your focus and your resources don't necessarily have to be on this gradual metric of getting to the baseline setting. And Zach, it might be different in your hospital setting or the way that your program is set up, because I know there's some incredible children's hospitals in this country that have the capacity to do this type of weaning in the acute setting, but on like a subacute floor or something like that. So it just depends on having the right setting. But the whole point is that, yes, it doesn't necessarily need an ICU resource to do that. But there's a big difference between ICU and home. You think about it so often, whereas like in the ICU, you know, you might even be reluctant to discharge an asthmatic because there's so much teaching that goes into, you know, into discharging an asthmatic that doesn't need to happen in the ICU. It's kind of like a similar concept, but in some ways a lot more alarming because you're sending home a child with a now artificial airway. So to me, it's just kind of like a shock when we say, okay, let's go from the ICU to home, because we don't even do that in children who are far less sick, or we try not to do that in children who are far less sick.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crib. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as a replacement for medical advice. It's also worth noting that the views expressed during this episode by me, Zach, and our guests are our own and do not reflect the official position of our institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at pedscritpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to help support the production of Peds Crit, you can find us on Venmo and Patreon. We've also had some light merch made in the form of Peds Crit laptop stickers. And if you include a mailing address with any contribution, we would be so excited to send you one. Thank you again for listening.